And I suddenly had this very strong sense of vertigo. Like, what is this? These spiky, painful, difficult to reconcile parts of this story that I thought I was living within is either complete fiction, or if it's not fiction, then God is not who I thought God was. Oh, I've built my life on a lie, and I don't know where else to build it now. There is a sense of like the only way out is through. It doesn't all need to be tidy and neat, but that doesn't mean the love of God has gone away.
Welcome, everybody. This is Simon Gilbert with Inspired. Great to be back for another fantastic week. I'm really looking forward to this one. Listen, I think if you're new to us, most of us, I think, would agree we get relentlessly bombarded on the media by 24/7 stuff that makes us cynical and anxious and depressed and negative and pessimistic. And what we need is to definitely tune into a different narrative that brings hope and joy and encouragement and inspiration. And this week, I've got no doubt you're going to be inspired and encouraged because we got with us the wonderful Elizabeth Oldfield. Welcome, Elizabeth.
The real joy to be here.
So good to have you. So Elizabeth and I first met in, I think it was Shift Conference 2019. I was trying to work it out because I think it was pre-lockdown. With the wonderful Caleb Meekins, and it was on the Troughton Farm just outside Cheltenham, Gloucester. Caleb has started this movement Shift, and I just, because tragically a year later he died, that was the last time I saw him alive, I just wanted to start by sort of paying homage to him, if you like. I'll tell my story, but first of all, Elizabeth, why don't you tell sort of your connection to him?
Yeah, so Caleb and I only met in passing at that festival. But the reason I was there is that we live with a couple called Hattie and Ramsey El-Kazan in our Christian intentional community. And Ramsey was one of the co-founders of Shift with Caleb and one of his best friends. And so we walked with them through that grief, that devastation of the loss of Caleb, and have really wanting to continue to be inspired by his fire, his optimism and can-do spirit and energy in the heart of the house, the sense that more is possible than we know. If we will only trust and be prepared to be a bit uncomfortable and go on some adventures. So though I never knew him well, I feel like I have really been nourished by his legacy.
Well, he was much later than me at Loughborough, but we had that connection. Then I got him out to Burundi with me. I just saw so much potential in him. What I loved is that he set up, amongst many things, a serial entrepreneur, but he set up this 40 days of failure. And he just basically got mates to send him in challenges that he was almost doomed to fail at, and like getting into Wimbledon or buying a Lamborghini on the King's Road in London dressed as a sheikh. But my favourite one was on a train. He was a lousy singer, a terrible singer, and he was challenged to go on the tube and do a solo. And so it takes real balls and courage, doesn't it? He stood up in front of everyone. Everyone's sort of putting their heads down, and he goes, "Listen, everybody, my name's Caleb and I really want to do a solo. And this is my first time ever singing publicly. So I'd love you to sing with me. You're going to sing Stand By Me." So he went for it and stone silence. No one responded. And he came to the end and he was like, "Oh, that wasn't very good." And he said, "Listen, guys, this is really hard. I'm going to give it another go. Please, please sing with me." And then the second time round, a builder and one other lady sang with him. And then he was like, "Oh, it's coming. Can we try once more?" And then the whole carriage let rip singing Stand By Me. And it was this sense of going from zero to 100, no fear. He redefined failure. Instead of being a stumbling block, can be a stepping stone and just put yourself out there. And I mean, millions of people saw his different stuff. So Caleb Meekins, it's one of those things we just can't work out, can we? His father had died in a plane crash where there were survivors. And as the plane went down, his father, who worked for Tearfund, had stood up and preached the gospel. So that was his legacy. As his dad died, he knew that he died sharing Jesus, as the survivors testified. But a lot of us, Ramsey, obviously, and Hattie included in that, just was struggled to get our heads around why, you know, the Lord in his sovereignty allows these things to happen. It's a bit of a head screw, isn't it? But anyway, that's the start of the podcast. Just wanting to honor him, because that's how we first met. And then I saw Elizabeth recently when preaching at her local church, and she's married to Chris, who is a philosopher. At the time, you were running a think tank called Theos. You did that for about 10 years, and then you do this sacred podcast, which you're going to talk about, which I've listened to gazillions of episodes of. So interesting. Intentional community, we're going to talk about that because that's so utterly different from how most people are living. But from your book, Fully Alive, in the introduction, you talk about your daughter singing When I Grow Up from the musical Matilda, and you end up bursting into tears Why that reaction?
Yeah, I think lots of people feel this when they become parents. Our sense of the weight of the world, the depth of human brokenness, our ability to mess things up really comes into focus because we become aware of what we're handing on. And there is something about that song, It's So Beautiful, When I Grow Up, the naivete of it. You know, when you grow up, you will just eat sweets and watch TV, and how brilliant will be being a grown-up be. And there is something very bittersweet about knowing the beauty and the brutality of the world, and the hope that we have in the love of God, and the tension of the now and the not yet that we live in. So yeah, it set me off on this sense of, okay, what does it mean to be people who can live in these times? And maybe it's always been these times, right? But what does it mean to live in times of tumult and the future seeming very uncertain, and be steady and be becoming people of some use in these times?
So going right back, your parents weren't religious, were they? I mean, I think your dad had a veneer of faith, but your mum from an atheistic background. But you go with a friend on a festival. I'm guessing it was either New Wine or Soul Survivor, was it?
Mm. It was Soul Survivor, yeah.
Right, go on. And tell us about this hinge moment you describe in your life.
Yeah, it's funny. I realized I started telling that story differently. Memory is a funny thing, isn't it? My mum was definitely not religious and not a Christian before I was. But I think my dad remembers that part of my childhood differently. It's funny, isn't it? When we have these kind of evangelical conversions and we're part of these very emotional and external parts of the church, the quieter bits of the church, the slower, maybe the older bits of the church, it's easy to dismiss when you're younger. And I think that's essentially what I did. There was church in my childhood. It was just quite understated, and we never talked about it at home. Mm-hmm. But I'm realizing that doesn't mean it wasn't serious for my dad. He was just so private, and of a generation that he just didn't really know how to talk about it to me. So I feel like in my early retellings of my testimony, I slightly dishonored that part, sure, that gift of my childhood. But yes, there was this, you know, occasional brushes with an aging Methodist church, and then a brief period, I think, of letting it go, of being a young, very young teenager and thinking, this is not relevant, this is not interesting. And then I was invited by a friend of mine from school to go to her youth group initially. And I was like, whoa, young people, whoa, you know, teenage boys and the hot chocolate with mini marshmallows when I was from a house that wasn't allowed sugar, you know. And all those things that are not deep, but do draw you at that age. And they eventually took us to Soul Survivor. And that week, I think, was such a hinge in my life, because I started the week thinking, well, this is all very nice, and I'm really glad to get to go to the skate park, and it's fun to be, you know, low adult supervision. But these guys are mad. Like, why are they talking in these crazy languages? Everyone's so shiny and happy. I'm going to just stay on the edges. And then towards the end of the week, really began to feel this draw, and had this moment of real surrender and powerful encounter that I've probably spent most of my life still figuring out what it meant, sometimes trying to deny it, but never being able to avoid this sense that I had been met.
Mm. Because you're working amongst very sharp people and very bright people and from different walks of life, are you resistant to going to the details of that? Because I'd love to hear more of what that actually looked like, that liminal experience.
Yeah, no, I'm not resistant at all. It's just hard to talk about. There are things that are beyond language, right? I think the external details were that Mike Pilavarci was preaching. We were in was when it was in the converted cow shed. Yeah. So it had this faint smell of manure.
Very familiar.
Red flip down chairs. And it was not a familiar environment for me. I had occasionally sung hymns in a Methodist church, right? And mostly what I remember from that is that you flip open the book and then you count the verses to work out how long this incredibly boring thing is going to go on for. That was my strong sense of church, was boredom.
Mm.
And then there was this electric atmosphere and people were weeping and they were cheering and they were dancing. And I remember this real battle between the skeptic in me, which is quite strong, this kind of intellectually questioning part of me, and a longing and a sense of hunger. And so I framed it in my head as an experiment. I was like, okay, I'm going to ask and probably nothing will happen. I put my hands out and I said, so reliable. It always makes me cry. I said, God, if you're there, would you show me? And sometime later, I came around on the floor. There was a woman who was praying for me. And the gap, that, like, from the praying and the coming to, there are no words for that. Like, I have tried. I had a long conversation with an editor for the New York Times who wanted me to write about this. And I was like, the pen ricochets off it. This is why the mystics are so insistent on the end of language, right? The bit of our brain that processes language is the analytical bit that's trying to capture in concepts and kind of pin things down, right? And that's that falls apart when you get close to an encounter with God.
Yeah.
It's why I think music gets closest, or poetry is the only type of words that has ever felt it gets anywhere near to me. But yeah, that's, I can't really talk about it because I don't think it's a talkaboutable thing. Yeah. It's a relational, embodied, transcendent knowing.
Yeah. Well, that's very well expressed. And I suppose Jesus says by the fruit, and the fruit of that encounter was immediate, wasn't it? You go home.
Yeah.
That difference is apparent. Tell us what happened.
Yeah. I remember walking through the door. I don't think I'd showered for days. I walked through the door and my mum said, what has happened to you? So what do you mean? She said, what has happened to you? You look different. And I was like, I think I'm a Christian now. and about sometime during that following year, my mum decided to go on an ALF course. And my mum is now one of the most amazingly prayerful,
wonderful.
Like, she has provided prayer cover for me, and she just adopts godchildren. Mm. Like, all my friends who became Christian later in life or have complex relationships with their parents or whatever it is, she'll just be like, right, you're under my covering now. I'm praying for you. And yeah, it's a glorious thing.
Wonderful. Well, Mummy, if you're listening, I'd love to be under your prayer covering as well. Why not? So teenage years, I mean, it sounds like you had a sort of just a steady progression and growth in faith, yeah?
Yeah, I did. I'd say towards the end of my teenage years, I started dating someone who wasn't a Christian. And that was, weirdly enough, it was really clarifying. My lovely youth leaders, who were incredibly well-meaning, went in two different directions. And one of them was like, this is a snare from Satan. Mm. It will steal your faith. Do not be unequally yoked. Did quite a harsh slam down of understandable hesitation around my choices. And the other one said, look, I'm not sure that this is the right decision for you, but I trust that God has you and we're going to walk with you and we're going to love him. And it allowed me to stay in relationship and friendship and to still feel welcome and not feel judged, right? And I think that was a real lifeline. And so actually over the course of dating him, it became clearer and clearer to me that this was a non-negotiable for me, and that if I was going to ever be married, I needed to be married to someone who, the phrase that always came to me was, if I'm ever in hospital with a sick child and my husband can't pray with me, that would be bad, you know? And so that season actually really deepened my sense of what it was like to live without that, and actually how hard that was for him and how much he wanted it but didn't seem able to get there, and the sort of the lack if I had walked away from it. I was part of lovely churches and I had just a very precious, easy, emotionally comforting sense of God's presence for years.
Hey folks, as you know, this podcast comes out under the auspices of Great Lakes Outreach, and we're working in Burundi, which is a beautiful country. It's got so many challenges. Listen, this is the toughest time of year as a parent, because schooling apparently is free in Burundi, but you have to provide the uniform, the books, the pens, that sort of thing. And that prohibits a whole bunch of people going to school. I've got three kids, and can you imagine that you can only afford to send one kid and you have to choose which one? That's a sort of dilemma lots of our ministry partners are in. And I just cannot imagine being faced with that choice. So we've got just under 1,000 people through the 30 organizations we support out there. And so could you sponsor one family or three families, five families, 10 families, whatever? That'd be wonderful. GreatLakesOutreach.org www.ecoworld.org/back-to-school if you want to sponsor 1, 3, 5, 10 families, whatever. And so that we can take away the stress of these precious, precious co-workers. You know, one colleague said to me, I hate it that often it's ministry families who are the first to drop out of school. That is so wrong, isn't it? So not on our watch. That's not going to happen. Please support one family or a few at greatlakesoutreach.org/back-to-school. It's about £40, $50 a pop. That'd be wonderful. And let's see all these kids get a good education. And education means they've got a good chance in life. All right. Thanks so much for your consideration. Now let's get back to the podcast.
And so you got a massive brain. So you're clearly bright. So school was plain sailing academically. Did you absolutely cruise? Were you lazy? Did you work hard?
I would say school was relatively easy, and I didn't go to particularly good schools or that. I mean, I went to a decent university, but I didn't go to that serious university. So I didn't have to work that hard, which probably suited me well because I also have a high appetite for fun.
And would you say that you were consistent in your living out the faith through university years? What was it like that?
Great question. Yeah, I think my boyfriend and I broke up early on in university, and I was really fortunate to meet some Christian friends. I never had Christian friends before that. Like, being a teenage Christian, I sort of was in a youth group, but it was kind of like, this is a dutiful, if anyone from my former youth group listening to this, I'm really sorry, that sounds much meaner than I mean, but there was no one that I hung out with outside of that, right? Like, I didn't have meaningful friendships with anyone else who had this relationship with God. And when I found those people at university, it was such a relief. Because they were also really fun. So I had this gang of friends that I would go clubbing with. And we would often end up like 3 o'clock in the morning praying for people. Now I think about it, it's very Caleb, I gather. The sense that the fully aliveness means that there's a lot of freedom, right? It doesn't mean that there's a license, but that we don't need to feel like we're going to be corrupted because I wasn't really raised in the evangelical church. I didn't have anxieties about who I was seen with or who I was friends with or what I was doing. You know, I wasn't getting off my face, but that combination of people who loved Jesus and loved other people and loved adventure and really wanted to like suck the marrow out of the university experience worked really well for me.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, me too. Absolutely loved it. You know, second century theologians say, Irenaeus, the glory of God is a person, a man, a woman, fully alive. And, you know, for me, that fully aliveness was all my shirts and shorts changing color with the sweat on the dance floor, just so letting rip. And I look back with such fondness on those days. So you end up working at the BBC. I mean, that was a critical part of your journey, wasn't it? So how did you get there and what happened?
Well, I had felt like I was going to be an actor. So I had done loads of drama at school. Drama A level, I thought it was going to be Judi Dench. That was the plan. I was like, I'm going to be a national treasure. There's some pride issues to deal with still in me. But I was going to go to university and then I was going to go to RADA and I was going to be a Shakespearean actor. That was what I had thought I was going to be. And then in my first summer holidays, I went to Kenya with Tear Fund. And there was something about the experience of being immersed in the obscene injustice of the world. My Western privileged assumption of what normal was completely washed away. And the sense of the groaning of creation, right? And the moral seriousness of a call to live out the faith. And the Christians out there, they're just like, I was like, my goodness me, I have got such a long way to go before I should even be thinking about calling myself someone who's following Jesus. I came back and I still loved drama, but I really felt like God said to me quite a strong sense of there's a no there, that if you pursue this career as an actor, there is not peace about this and there is not favor on it because your character is not ready. The bit of me that had an ego that was both kind of easily puffed up and also easily hurt will not do well in this career, because I was in all these drama productions at university and I'd be the leading actor in the drama and then I'd walk around campus and people were like, well done, you did such a great thing. I'd be like, well, thank you so much. And the formation of that path, I think, is incredibly difficult. Yeah. And God said no. It was hard, because then I was like, what am I going to do? Bear in mind, a lot of me still felt quite a new Christian. I was like, what do Christians do? Like, all the Christian women I know are either full-time moms or they work for Tier Fund, because I knew a bit about Tier Fund, or some of them primary school teachers. I don't know if it was true, but there was certainly this perception that to be a Christian woman, you had to have one of these like very demure, caring kind of professions. Mm. And I was like, my character, like, I'm too gobby for that. Like, I don't feel any desire for any of those things. And I was writing all these essays doing history and English, writing about culture, cultural stories, history and English, and how the, like, the great engine of culture forms us. I remember lying in my bed in my like very tiny room, and I said, Lord, I'm so interested in this. I don't know why you wouldn't want me to go in that direction. And I felt like God said, did I ever say that I didn't? Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, I'm allowed to just do what I'm interested in? And I got up in the middle of the night and I applied for an internship at the BBC. And I went to campus the next day and said, I've applied for the internship at the BBC. And all my friends were like, oh yeah, everyone applies for that. No one gets it. But the people who've done student radio for 3 years are the only ones with any chance of getting... I was like, oh, I haven't done any student radio. And then 2 weeks later, I got a yes. And the first thing I did when I finished university is I went and did a month internship at the BBC and then went straight into a job there. And so I worked in radio drama, where they make radio plays for Radio 4. And then I worked briefly in TV drama. And then I worked on things like The Moral Maze on Radio 4. But the first TV job I got was working on a dramatization of the Bible. And that's when those two interests came together.
And your faith gets very challenged as you dig into First and Second Chronicles, is it? There are some challenging passages for our faith, aren't there?
Yeah. Well, honestly, I think the whole Bible. Mm. I've probably been a Christian for 6 or 7 years, and I was in lovely, lovely churches. But fundamentally, I knew the nice bits, right? I knew the fridge magnet bits. I knew the memory verses. I knew bits of the Gospels. I had never opened huge swathes of the Bible, and I certainly had never been taught to read it as anything other than a lovely, straightforward book from God that gives us instructions on our life, right? Mm. And so I showed up, and the team were made up of people with strong theological knowledges. They often had theology degrees from Oxford or Cambridge, but my perception of the time was certainly that there is a level of kind of discouragement, cynicism. They were in a different place from me faith-wise. Some of them had never had any faith and were just interested in it intellectually. And lots of them were just there because they were really good at making good TV. And they gave me Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Chronicles, and 1 and 2 Kings. That was the episode, going to be an episode in a drama. And I needed to understand everything about these books, what the stories were, what the origins were, and how we could present them on screen. And so I rang all these experts, and people pick up the phone when you're from the BBC, even if you're like a ridiculous 22-year-old. I'd be like, hi, I'm from the BBC. Will you talk to me about the book of Joshua? And so people would be like, okay, this is when we think it was written. This is what it is. This is obviously why it never happened. This is the genocide. These are all the rape texts. Like, and I suddenly had this very strong sense of vertigo. Hmm. Like, what is this? What are these spiky, like, raw, painful, difficult to reconcile parts of this story that I thought I was living within, and now I don't think I want to be living within, because it's brutal. It's either complete fiction, or if it's not fiction, then God is not who I thought God was. Mm. It was very lonely, because I'd moved to Manchester. I didn't really have any friends. All of my Christian friends, I felt this, like, I don't want to sully them with my doubts. Mm-hmm. As you can tell, I'm quite mouthy. I talk to people about everything. It's the only thing in my life that I've ever felt like I can't share with anyone, because I will spread the contagion. And they're so happy in their lovely, naive, straightforward Christianity. And now I've seen the truth, I don't want to damage their bubble. But yeah, a very, very dark few months of, oh, I've built my life on a lie, and I don't know where else to build it now.
I was reading this morning. I mean, it's actually really important for all of us to go through those stages. We can't live with the saccharine verses, the fridge magnet ones you're talking about. But I was reading this morning, Bono, U2's Bono, my mum calls him Bono. And he said this. He said, belief and confusion are not mutually exclusive. I believe that belief gives you a direction in the confusion, but you don't see the full picture. That's the point. That's what faith is. You can't see it. It comes back to instinct. Faith is just up the street. Faith and instinct. You can you can't just rely on them. You have to beat them up. You have to pummel them to make sure they can withstand it, to make sure they can be trusted.
Yeah, I do. Like, I'm really grateful for it now. And I have a similar sense. Like, when I meet Christians who have never had a dark night of the soul, who've never wrestled, who've never had the sense of the ground falling away from under their feet, I feel worried for them. I'm like, what are you suppressing? What are you? And when is it coming? Like, because there is a sense of like the only way out is through. And it's the people who have had to take it all apart and see if it fits together again, that there's an honesty, right? There's an honesty about it. There's an amazing poet called Christian Wyman, who I was just with in DC, and he wrote so beautifully about doubt and faith and things sliding in and out of focus, and just a higher tolerance of all we don't know. Mm. That when we're grounded in the one thing I'm still sure of, which is the love of God and the centrality of Jesus, then I can just hold the tension of lots of other things not having a lot of certainty on, honestly. So I'm grateful for it now, but it was awful. Mm. I felt this strong sense of abandonment. And it turned when a friend from my old church in London said, we're going on this apologetics training weekend run by the Zacharias Trust. And there's someone's dropped out. So there's a paid place. You can come to this really nice hotel and all your food and drink is paid for. And you don't have to come to any of the sessions, but we'd just love to see you. And you can just come and you can go on long walks while we do apologetic sessions. You know, we can just read your novel. And I thought, okay, I would like to see my friends. Like, they know that something's going on, but they don't know very much. Maybe I should be a bit more honest with them about what's going on. Went to this weekend, and the first thing they used to do is get out a flip chart and say, give all your hardest questions. One question from over there and one question from over there. And then I was like, hold my beer. here is my clipboard of questions. I think the room was quite awkward because I'm like, who is this girl? And why won't she, like, why? And I was angry. I was really angry. I was really sad. I felt lied to. It was like 1 Corinthians this, like 1 Chronicles this, 2 Chronicles 4. These are all the things I have problems with. And there was something about they're like, great, bring it on. This is nothing we've not heard before. Yeah. You, not in a mean way, but there was a very strong sense of like, you are not the first person to have noticed that there are some sharp edges in this thing.
Mm.
And we are going to walk and think together and surface these and allow honesty and space. And where people have found really helpful answers, we're going to share those together. And where there are things that are never fully resolvable, we're going to be honest about that together. And we're going to hold it in the light of the love of God. And it just like, the relief of it. I remember getting in the taxi on the way back to the station and sharing the gospel with the driver, because I was suddenly like,
Yeah. This
thing can hold it. It doesn't all need to be tidy and neat, but that doesn't mean the love of God has gone away.
Mm. I know that a bunch of people be listening who maybe have deconstructed their faith and they haven't found their way back.
Mm.
You often quote, don't you, that poem, who's it by? Staying Power.
Mary Walker, yeah. Yeah.
Have you got that with you?
Let me look it up.
So folks, listen up, because obviously a poem is seriously meaty and it's distilled wisdom. So if you weren't really concentrating on your dog walk or washing up or driving the kids to school, just really concentrate for the next 2 minutes. Go for it.
Staying Power by Jean Murray Walker. Like Gorky, I sometimes follow my doubts outside the yard and question the sky, longing to have the fight settled, thinking, I can't go on like this. And finally, I say, all right, it is improbable. All right, there is no God. And then, as if I'm focusing a magnifying glass on dry leaves, God blazes up. It's the attention, maybe, to what isn't there that makes the emptiness flare like a forest fire until I have to spend the afternoon dragging the hose to put the smoldering thing out. Even on an ordinary day, when a friend calls, tells me they found melanoma, complains that the hospital is cold, I say, God, God, I say, as my heart turns inside out, pick up any language by the scruff of its neck, wipe its face, set it down on the lawn, and I bet it will toddle right into the God fire again, which, though they say it doesn't exist, can send you straight to the burn unit. Oh, we have only so many words to think with. Say God's not fire. Say anything. Say got a phone, maybe. You know you didn't order a phone, but there it is. It rings, and you don't know who it could be. You don't want to talk, so you pull out the plug. It rings, and you smash it with a hammer till it bleeds, springs, and coils and clobbery metal bits. It rings again. You pick it up, and a voice you love whispers, "Hello."
Very powerful. When you first read that, how did it resonate?
I remember Jamie Smith read it at an event we did for Theos. And it's such a relief. I love poetry. Poetry is one of the few forms that I can read about God for the reasons we were talking about earlier. And good poetry is always honest. You can tell bad poetry because it doesn't feel honest. And to have someone put into words that wrestle, that fight, that wanting to believe, sometimes not wanting to believe, the days where it all stops making sense, and the relentless faithfulness of a God that comes towards us is just, it's real grace.
Hey folks, I hope you're enjoying the podcast. If you want to join our WhatsApp group, it's just one ping a week, but it's an easy way of forwarding on to other people. The details will be in the blurb and the show notes below. One thing I'd love to offer you is that my publishers have let me put on our daily devotional Choose Life online. So tens of thousands of people have enjoyed the book, but over the last few years we've had it online for free, and that could be a daily email or a weekly email. So for that, just go to chooselife.org.uk. Now, let's get back to the podcast.
So, all right, I'm picturing you evangelizing on the taxi on the way back. So you're back in the game, but you're different. There's a greater depth and confidence that allows for doubts, that doesn't think that that's letting the side down. What was the journey forward from that?
I think it became clear that at least part of who I am is an evangelist. And I didn't know that before because I wasn't really involved in CU at university, but I did a couple of evangelism trainings with them and really struggled because it felt like there was some kind of formula and that I could get it wrong. Right. And I think probably there was some like doubts underneath that I'd not dealt with, and therefore just wasn't confident that I was offering something secure, maybe. And after, there's never really been anything but freedom in it, because I don't feel like I'm having to defend God or like be PR for God. Mm-hmm. I feel so relaxed that there is love at work in the world and there is grace available to us, and that for the people that want it, it can't be anything but a gift. But I don't have to force it or manipulate anyone. I can just love them and ask good questions. And then very regularly, without very much thought, we end up two clicks over from the gospel. So I'm insanely grateful. Even, you know, Soul Survivor and the Zacharias Trust, like the two key beats in my testimony, are very complicated now, yeah, as institutions of great leadership failure and so much ick and darkness and sadness. And yet I continue to be grateful for the role they played in my life and the truth that goodness can coexist with real brokenness.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I, likewise, as an evangelist, we are very different kind of evangelists, and we're going to reach very different people, aren't we? And that's what the beautiful tapestry of God's creation is, isn't it? So go on, share some of your stories through, why not through Theos? 10 years at Theos, this think tank. What would you say were your greatest grace-breaking in moments there?
Yeah. Well, interesting enough, Theos doesn't exist to vandalize. It exists just to create some space in the public conversation. It's about legitimacy, or like plausibility structures. Mm-hmm. The assumptions lots of people have, particularly in the world of ideas, in the political world is that Christianity is either hateful or it's stupid, right? Mm. And so Theos exists to offer the treasures of the wisdom of the Christian tradition in ways that are credible and intelligent and gracious and hospitable. And just say, if we're thinking about what makes a good society, it's possible that there are some resources for us here about what human being is, about how we care for each other, about what justice looks like. So one of the phrases we used about Theos was, we want to be an antihistamine for people with an allergy to religion. Just so they could, like, I often thought about, like, the particularly the Christian intellectual tradition as a rose bush that people had hay fever. And if we could just, like, bring down their hay fever, they could get close to it. And we weren't saying that it didn't have any thorns. We're like, there are things in our history that are sharp, but there's also beauty and goodness in it. And that the way to be an antihistamine for people was to be in relationship with them. Funnily enough, we are people made in the image of a Trinitarian God. We are made for relationship. We are called to love God and love our neighbors and love our enemies. And so bizarrely, as a think tank that was doing really rigorous research, you know, polling, qualitative and quantitative research, lots of, you know, smart stuff coming out, the most effective thing we ever did was being in relationship with people,
yeah.
Was seeking to serve people, to being like, how can we help? What do you need? Well done. Like people outside, people with no particular connection to Christianity, just rather than being like, you are the enemies and we are going to just try and lob Bible bombs at you, being amongst the people making culture and walking with them and loving them and applauding what was good and trying to be people who could be trusted and people who acted with integrity. Quite often we do polling, and if the headline didn't make the church look good, we would still put it out. And that meant people saw us as people who were honest.
Mm.
And so we'd get on all these relationships with people who trusted us and felt liked, felt respected by us. And then very often after whatever the actual conference was, or I'd give evidence in the House of Lords or whatever, and blah, 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 blah. And then we'd go to the pub or the cafe, or we'd be walking out and someone would go really quietly, you know, I've always been a little bit interested in Christianity, but I've never known where to start.
Mm.
And people, Buddhists would sidle up to me at conferences on psychedelics and go, I can't, every time I try and meditate, Jesus keeps popping up. What do I do about it? And being just a public Christian who people could tell didn't hate them,
yeah,
meant that all of these sort of peripheral relational interactions, and so it was almost like a side job where I'd be putting out research reports and then I'd be chaplaining journalists and politicians and business people who suddenly were like, the hunger to have someone who they could bring their questions to, who wasn't going to like trying to forcibly baptize them. So it became clear to me that so much of this is about the relational posture and the tone of being someone who's trustworthy. And then my experience is people will come to you.
Mm. And lots have come to you over the years. If we talk about the sacred podcast, that's been going a long time now, almost a decade, hasn't it? 2017, I think you started. And you often quote Barack Obama, don't you? If you listen hard enough, everyone's got a sacred story. How did they come to believe what they believe? And you've had such an extraordinary range of people on the show. Give us your highlights from there.
Wow. So the design is that I speak to people from all different perspectives, tribes, backgrounds, and I try and listen really deeply to understand them. And that's grounded in the New Testament nonviolent tradition. My sense, the quote I come back to all the time is by Ralph Ausberger, and it says, to be listened to is for the ordinary person as close to being loved as to be indistinguishable.
Mm.
And so I'll be talking to people who are atheists or witches or Muslims, people from the hard right and the hard left, people who believe different things about Brexit or race or gender or whatever it is. And just seeking to understand and listen and reflect back often ends up by the end of that hour feeling, you must have experienced this, feeling like it's actually a bond there. Mm. There's a sense of affection. It's quite hard to listen to someone deeply and not for them not to become fully human, yeah, before your very eyes. And it means that I have had conversations with people who I went into thinking this is going to be really difficult, and got to the end and thought, I think I'm seeing you a little bit how God sees you now. And that can be everyone from, I spoke to Rod Dreher, who Rod, I like have this bizarre relationship with. He is friends with J.D. Vance, who wrote this book called Reenchanting, where I say I agree with about 50% of what he says, and I radically disagree with about 50% of it. And I find him very discombobulating for that sense. And I go back and forth from thinking you're a good faith actor to you're a very dangerous person to just can't get my head around him because we read all the same poetry, we're interested in the same things. And in that conversation with him, I was really able to be really honest about that. And to not need to collapse it, to not need to say, I'm going to put you in the good guy or the bad guy category. Yeah. I'm just going to treat you as actually a brother in Christ. And there's one called Sophie Lewis, who is possibly the like photo negative of Rod Dreher, right? She wrote a book called Abolish the Family. She is a revolutionary Marxist. She believes the family is like a oppressive unit and we should communalize care. She doesn't really think that the bond between a biological child and their mother is necessarily stronger than any other kind of bond. She has all these views that the social conservative in me finds really uncomfortable. And by the end of that, I was like, oh gosh, I can see your heart. I can see your pain from your family. Mm. I can see your longing for justice. Mm. And she talked about the utopia she longs for being something that we enact in the now, that, and she used the phrase something like the now and the not yet. And I was like, I know what that feels like. You feel about this, like I feel like the kingdom of God. Yeah. And she's like, yes, I do. And the seeking to find the points of connection, the hope is now Sophie will go away and be like, there is a Christian that rather than calling me all kinds of names, listened to me and sought to understand.
Yeah.
And that's changed my sense now of what Christians are like and how, that it might ever be possible for us to move towards each other. And that's always, the Tim Keller always said, the move you're trying to take people on as you share the gospel is from we're nothing alike, so I could never be a Christian, to, well, you're like me, you can't really be a Christian, to, you're like me and you're a Christian, maybe it's not impossible that someone like me could come to believe something like that. And honestly, it sounds so simple, but listening to people with respect and openness and curiosity, not agreeing with them, you don't have to affirm positions in order to acknowledge the humanity in a person. Again and again, I'll be like, wow, that's really powerful.
Yeah. So I know some people's stories you'd be wrong to divulge and their journey's ongoing, but have you got any stories that you are allowed to share of those very bright people in their different fields actually coming to faith?
Yeah, lots of them I wouldn't talk about, but Louise Perry is someone who's spoken publicly about it, so I can. And Louise was someone I interviewed years and years ago when she just had a column on the New Statesman. Her book wasn't yet out. And I kind of saw her in the corner of my eye. I thought, there's a mind at work. Something's happening in that thinking. She'd be interesting to talk to.
Who is she, for those who don't know?
So Louise Perry she was a New Statesman columnist. She ran a campaign called We Can't Consent to This. She did lots of campaigning against sexual violence and worked in a rape crisis centre, was a dyed-in-the-wool classic feminist. She talked about having two copies of The Guardian arriving at her house when she was a child so that everyone in her family could read The Guardian at the same time. And then got interested in whether some of our approaches to sex and relationships in liberal culture were actually serving women. Wrote a book called Against the Sexual Revolution, and is now, she's often badged a conservative feminist. So she is interested in how the particularly Christian and other religious approaches to essentially restraint, sexual restraint, seeing sex as something that is to be treated with care might actually be better for us than a kind of hypersexualized, fully liberalized culture.
And I was listening to her a few months ago with 5,000 other people at the Royal Albert Hall with a very clear faith. She's a beautiful sister in Christ. That's wonderful, wonderful. Oh, listen, we're running out of time, but I really want to get to your book, Fully Alive. Now, I was again reminiscing this morning about when we were together at in 2019 at the Shift Conference. My title or my sort of theme for my three talks was Fully. So the first one was Fully Committed. 2 Chronicles 16, verse 9. The eyes of the Lord range throughout the earth to strengthen those whose hearts are fully committed to Him. And then it was Fully Known. That was 1 Corinthians 13:12. Now we see any reflection as in a mirror, then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And then the last one was Romans 12, about fully surrendered, offering our bodies as a living sacrifice. Now your book is fully alive from that quote from second century theologian St. Irenaeus, the glory of God is man or woman fully alive. Now, I definitely want to get to chapter 8, which is from individualism to community. But before we major in on the last section on that, just share whatever you really want to get out of that.
So the book was fruit of a decade having these kind of conversations with people who didn't think Christianity had anything to offer, might be kind of actively harmful force in the world. And in friendship and honesty and creating space, many of them realizing there might actually be wisdom and goodness in that, and how easy I had found it actually to find ways to bridge to the things they're interested in and the concerns that we all share about what does a good life look like and how do we grow up our souls and what does it mean to be living well in these times. And so I wrote a book of essays loosely structured around the seven deadly sins, and really arguing that the concept of sin, rightly understood as relational fracture, needed rehabilitating, could be a really, is, I think, a psychologically insightful, potentially liberatory way of understanding human beings, and then flesh that out through the seven deadly sins. So looking at acedia is the word for sloth, looking at kind of endemic distraction in these times and how things like the rule of life and the church calendar and these contemplative practices can really help us, and wrath, looking at polarization and division and what the Christian peace building tradition might be able to tell us. And it's very much written to be not stocked in the religion section of the bookshop, but be stocked in the kind of modern wisdom section. So Oliver Berkman, who wrote 4,000 Weeks, lovely friend, blurbed it, talked about it on Ezra Klein's show, which means I'm getting to go and talk about it in all kinds of kind of mainstream ideas-y spaces, which was exactly my aim.
Well, listen, folks, I strongly recommend it. I haven't finished it, but it is absolutely brilliant. Elizabeth's a beautiful wordsmith, and we'll put that in the blurb. Chapter 8, From Individualism to Community. I picture you with Chris and your kids and Ramsey and Hattie and their little baby who's just arrived that you've been helping with this morning, and a few others around the table doing life together. Just, you know, share us what it's like. I'm sure it's all sweetness and light. There's never any tension. Go on.
Yeah, so we've been living together for 6 years, and it came out of this sense of, I think, but post kind of deconstruction, as it now being called, I did have this sense of, right, if I'm going to live this, I want to really do it. And I was very blessed to meet an amazing man with a serious faith, and a sense similarly of, we don't just want our faith to be this social thing or something around the sides, or to do what I saw was so easy, which is, as you gain more responsibility, as you had kids, maybe got a bigger job, bigger house, big mortgage, that the centrality of this relationship with God and living a radical life got really muffled. And the bit of the verse in the Bible which scares me the most is the end of the parable of the sower, when it says the cares of the world and the deceitfulness of wealth choked the life in them. And I was like, what does it look like to not let the cares of the world and the deceitfulness of wealth choke us? For whatever reason, I had this sense that the early church knew how to share, knew how to live close up, knew how to be accountable, because they actually knew each other, right, at a deep level. You're fully known, as you said, that being fully known by God and fully known by others feels to me like you can't really do the Christian life without that. So yes, we rented together first in the pandemic, and now there's now 8 of us in the house with the arrival of tiny baby 2 weeks ago, plus a cat, in quite a increasingly small feeling space in a London, big London family home, but there's a lot of us in it. And we have a rule of life where we pray together 3 mornings a week, and we have these open table dinners on a Monday, which lots of my podcast guests and Chris's philosopher friends and Hattie's film friends and Ramsey's business friends and our housemate Naomi's theatre friends come, and they meet each other and they chat. And then at the end of the evening, we say, we're going to go to the chapel at the end of the garden and pray Compline. You're so welcome if you'd like to come. And they say, what's Compline? And we say, it's the ancient monastic night prayer. And I always say, you can come and observe out of anthropological nosiness. You can come and join in if you're comfortable, or you can stay here and there's whiskey in that cupboard there, or you can go home at this stage. And the first time we did this, honestly, it was because we have these dinners on a Monday and people were staying too late. I was like, we need a cut-off point. Really? And we hadn't been doing Compline up till then. We'd only been doing morning prep.
Love that.
It was like, great. It was not out of some like great evangelical stratagem. It was, we need to go to bed now. People won't leave. And the first time I said it, I was like, they're all going to go now. And everyone stood up and came down the garden. And I would say 90% of guests say yes. And only about 10% of guests have Christian faith. And we have had so many people come and sit in candlelight, listening to these words, often joining in with these words. And the number of people that say to me, that's the first time I've ever prayed anything, or that's the first time I've witnessed prayer happening. Lots of people, it's been their like gentle entry point into being able to consider that this might be for them. We had a guy recently who was baptized a month ago, and he said, Compline at your house was the gateway drug.
Yes. What a great line. Compline being the gateway drug. I would never have thought of it in that way, but yes, amen. Mm. Wonderful. I mean, I've spent a small seasons of community working with the Salvation Army in the Red Light District in Hamburg, for example, you know, 6 months. Wow. Doing it longer term is all kudos to you. I mean, that's a beautiful thing.
It really requires a lot of rigor. And I feel more discipled through living in community than the entire rest of my Christian life, because it's where your illusions about yourself go to die.
Yeah.
Like, oh, wow, here is all this darkness and ridiculous, childish, possessive, grumpy nonsense in me. And then you can bring it out. And there's a strong enough container and a strong enough sense of stability and love that we are learning to love each other as we all grow up our souls. And it's good for witness, it's good for discipleship, it's good for joy, and sometimes it's really annoying.
Yeah. Listeners, I think it's really helpful for us to be majorly challenged by this. I often preach, be it Acts 2 or Acts 4, the end of both those chapters. I mean, Acts 4, almost every word you could exposit, it says all the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of their possessions was their own, but they shared everything they had, and with great dunamis power, the apostles continued to testify to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and God's grace was so powerfully at work in them all that there were no needy people among them. I remember it was Paul Perkin years ago preaching on these verses and saying, was God so liberal with his grace because they were so liberal with their lives and their possessions? And it's a tough gig. You're not sugarcoating it, but God has blessed you, but he's kept you sort of trusting in him, hasn't he? You're not rolling around in wealth right now.
No, we have enough, and it's amazing. Like, both my husband and I have strange callings that have taken us outside established, secure career pathways. And there've been lots of times where it's felt like these are big risks, you know, to move in with another family. We have a joint mortgage.
Yeah.
If they default, we are responsible, right? And vice versa. And the level of risk and exposure to commit your life to other people at this level, you know, there's a baby in the house right now. At the moment, his voice is tiny. He sleeps above us, right? We are likely to be pretty disturbed in our sleep over the next year. My daughter already is like struggling to sleep because she can hear him. So we're having to move rooms around. It's really costly. And we have never, we've always had enough. There's always, I mean, I would say more than enough. There's been abundance, and there's all this extra capacity released because we're not all doing this. Like, when there's two people in a household, that's a lot of jobs. That's a lot of tasks. That's a lot of chores. When there's five adults in the household, actually, I never shop. I only cook once a week. Someone else deals with the council tax, right? Like, we have all this extra time for our vocations, for our parenting, for each other, and to be good neighbors and to be reaching out into the street. And everything that's hard about it is in my flesh. Everything that's hard is revealing where I'm graspy and controlling, and I think that my way is the best way.
Yeah.
Iris Murdoch says, love is the very difficult realization that someone other than yourself is real. Mm. And I have had to do that. We've had to do that. And it feels like I am less comfortable and more human and a little bit more like Jesus than I would have been through unclenching my grasp on my stuff and my space and my time and my money.
Well, we've run out of time, but I want to give you a last word. But before that, just any more sort of vignette moments or lessons from living community you wanted to share?
We had someone come to our house recently who I think has had a really hard life and doesn't come that much. Comes for some of our open house days. And we don't have loads of capacity to walk really closely with them, actually. So we just try and... That's the capacity building thing. When you're doing a lot together as a house, there's more, you can care for more people because there's more of you. But they text me afterwards and said, your house is one of the few places I feel safe. Mm. People call it a refuge. The number of people who, and this is what we prayed for, but people walk through the door and say, gosh, it feels different. What is it about it? It feels different here. I always feel calm here, or I always know I'll be welcome here. And that's not because we're perfect. Like, we're still grumpy and tired and can't always meet people, but the spirit is in the house and the blessing of God, despite us, is over the house. And so the logic of the kingdom is very, very poorly through a glass darkly being imaged. And then you really don't have to do very much for people to be drawn.
Okay, well, Elizabeth, listen, we'll put the details on Fully Alive on the Sacred Podcast in the blurb, but give us some parting shot that you want to launch us out back into our week, back into our normal day-to-day life. Go for it.
So the phrase I use a lot is, we are made by God and made for God, and we also made for each other, and we are made by each other, and we are living in times that is trying to push humans apart. And I think the most powerful witness Christians can offer, one of the most powerful witnesses, is to be doggedly, stubbornly lashing ourselves to other people and resisting the tides of isolation and individualism and moving towards each other in sacrificial ways and uncomfortable ways, to love our neighbors as ourselves, to share all things in common. It might be the most countercultural thing we can be doing in these times, and it will also help us stay fully human. It is really important formation for our souls.
Hey, I knew it was going to be a good conversation. I knew it was going to be very different from anyone else, anyone on the others 270 odd that we've done. I thank you so much, Elizabeth, for your time.
Thank you so much for having me, and I'm really glad this whole project exists.
Yeah, brilliant. Whew, guys, I know this is the sort of conversation that you're going to want to forward to. You can think of key people maybe that are checking stuff out from the outside looking in, or just about clinging on from the skin of their teeth as the deconstruction process has been painful, just the sucker punches of life that have just sown more doubt or fear or ostracism from the body, whatever. So think of someone you could share it with, and may this podcast be life and light and truth and maybe healing to a whole number of people. I want to thank Adam Thomas here for the editing, Mike Sandin for the mixing. Next week, a very different guest with a very different story. I love the variety we get on this. But in the meantime, go for it. God bless you. Stay connected. Insist on getting connected if you're not connected. God bless you, and toodaloo.